Once upon a time, there was a writer's workshop. A group of writers, poets in this case, gathered in a living room-like parlor. Some college campus, maybe, or old mansion, fluffy chairs and old lamps. The truth is that this was a magical writer's workshop. I mean, really magical. The poets traveled there by flue powder and flying carpets and teleportation, and they came across time and space. No one took notes and no one saw them, but a grasshopper hiding in a corner came and told me all about it. And now I will tell you. After each poet got their beverage of choice, whiskey for some, seltzer water for others, hot tea for a few, and Diet Coke for a surly-looking fellow in the corner, they began to talk. Have you ever heard a group of poets talk? It's kind of like when a group of ministers talk, but even more pretentious. After a while, though, things got a little more honest. Then they began to talk about the most curious subject, work. One said, "Work, we know nothing of work, we are artists." But others shushed them and said, "No, our art is our work. We sit down at the typewriter, the paper and the inkwell, the keyboard, and we work. We research our references, we edit and rewrite, we work." There was a debate which lasted a few minutes. Then one who knew began to speak. Each morning, he told them, he got up and put on his suit and tie and went where he lived in Hartford, Connecticut, to his job at the insurance company. It was a job, and he did it. Reviewed claims, decided which to pay, which to contest, and how to defend the company's decisions if they got sued. He was a lawyer, and this was his job. And then he went home and wrote poems. Poems about objects and life and mystery. "But in contentment," he wrote, "but in contentment, I still feel the need for some imperishable bliss. Death is the mother of beauty, you see, and paradise need not be delayed. Beauty is in the windy lake and the trees and the echoing hills, men that perish and summer mourn. We go to work, yes, because we must, but then we come home and we write poems and sing songs and love and wonder, and that is our real life. That is what we are for, not what we do at work, but that imperishable bliss. Work is just how we pay the bills." "Wallace, Wallace," the poets shout, "no, it cannot be," say some. "So it cannot be that our work should be so unimportant. All the time we spend doing the task, it has to matter for something." But Mr. Stevens shakes his head and says, "No, it's just a job." Another poet, Mr. Stevens' contemporary, who was in fact the child of Unitarian ministers, those people who sought out new meaning on the frontier, the wild west of St. Louis, but this poet had himself rejected liberalism and progress in America in favor of tradition and England and Anglicanism. Anglican, I can't pronounce that. You know what I mean? Had a slightly different view. He had worked first as a banker and then as a publisher, a good day job for a poet. But Mr. Eliot said that his work was to turn the unpoetical into poetry and to fuse the matter of fact and the fantastic. That you could find meaning in the everyday and write about it and connect it to the ancient and the truth and the holy even. And that we journeyed into the world, but we only knew ourselves when we returned and knew the place as if for the first time. He spoke in large words with deep resonances to myth and history and faith, and he started to drone on. A woman, dirt under her fingernails from gardening, laughed, roared her head back and laughed. "She's my favorite," the grasshopper said to me, and I know why Mary so loved the grasshopper. The poet laughed at Mr. Eliot and Mr. Stevens, and then she fixed them in her gaze and asked, "What is life for? What is your life for? What are you for pushing papers and denying claims? for being hunched over the manuscript making notes? No. Let us wander the fields and go down to the water and notice sunflowers and clouds and how they sing. Tell me, she asked, a twinkle in her eye. Tell me what you will do with your one wild and precious life. Will you work at some job and only live your passion at night? Will you clock out the hours waiting for retirement so you can really do what you want? Or will you do what you want now? Will you find your passion and live it? Follow your calling, devote yourself to it. Miss Oliver's comments were met with some approval from a part-time college professor and full-time writer who was lounging in one of the fluffiest chairs. He leaned forward, put his finger in the air, and said, "Yes, yes. We must find our true heart and follow our true love and make something of our lives. We cannot simply grind out our days, work in a factory, and never get fired, except from the war till the day he retired, as if that was enough." Was he free? Was he happy? Mr. Auden sat back and proclaimed, "The question is not, in the end, absurd. It is everything." The poets argued for a while. Eventually, one of them started to sing. She was the first to admit she was not as good of a singer as her sister, but it got their attention and got them to pay attention to her. "You know," she said, "this is silliness. As if people get to choose. Do the work for work and the poetry for fun, or just do poetry, as if it was a choice, as if poets get paid well enough to hang out in coffee shops and wear berets all day." "I knew," she said, "if I wanted to write, I needed a job. And to get the job I needed an education. Who's gonna pay someone," she said, "to write black militant poetry?" "Thank God," she said, "for a woman's dean at Fisk who readmitted me after I got thrown out the first time. Thank God indeed. But these days," she said, "I worry for artists and poets, and I worry for workers, for lawyers and publishers and teachers and gardeners and factory workers at Fudge Motors, Inc., and salespeople and clerks and sanitation workers marching. I am a man, but there's still not enough in the paycheck. And I couldn't have gone to college today," she said. "Oh, sure, we'll let you in, Miss Giovanni," they would say. "You just have to sign for the loan. It's 8% interest and you'll pay forever." Is this the world we live in? "Is poetry," Nikki asked the others, "just about beauty? And about the merging of the everyday and the numinous? Is it about noticing grasshoppers, or is there more to it?" "That's all fine," she said, "but it's not enough. There's more. There's the question of justice. And if we are to talk about work, then we must talk about justice." "Hear, hear," cried out Mr. Auden and most of the others. T.S. fumed in the corner, but Nikki went on. "The question of work is a question of justice. Of course we must produce and contribute in some way, but the point of our lives is not to be useful to someone else who owns our labor. That is not what we are for. We must fight. Poets, too, even everyone, people died for work with dignity, for the 8-hour day and decent pay, for any pay at all, for holidays and for safety. People were killed for insisting on. And today, when people thrown in jail for having a little weed in their back pocket are forced to fight fires in prison uniforms for $1 an hour, when a paycheck buys less and less every year, when your job is outsourced and automated and you wonder, "Now what? Now what am I supposed to do?" When you feel like you have to bring your computer to the beach just in case you have an urgent email, you better get on that right away. These things are not equivalent, she says. They are not equivalent. But don't you think there is something horribly wrong here? Don't you think the question of work isn't just about personal meaning making, but also a question of justice? That we need here not judgment, but solidarity to build a world where, as my friend says, and she nods, as my friend says, they can't do to you whatever they want. Her friend Marge speaks up, it starts when you mean one more, singly none. Nikki's on a roll. The question of work is a question of justice as well as a question of meaning, she says. What would it mean if we weren't so desperate? If we had a cushion? If society took care of each other more instead of leaving us all to sink or swim on our own? What if we thought about it differently? I'm a poet, not an economist, but what if we got creative? What if children didn't live in desperate poverty? What if people could walk away from a boss who abused them? What if folks didn't have to break their backs into their 70s in order to survive? I don't know the answer, but I think we should think about it, don't you? Most of the poets agreed. One of them, not as famous as the others, began to tell a story. It was a story about his dad and the birdhouses he made. He said he never signed his work, but his name was on the wing of every bird who flew from there into the waiting sky. The point is this, he said. It is about justice. Nikki is right. And it is about your desire. Deep in your being, Mary's right about that. And it is about finding the beauty in the everyday and the meaning in the mundane as we do. That's our job. And it's also about making something with your body, with your mind, with your heart. The point of our lives is not to be productive. It's not about being useful for someone else's capital. That's not why we exist. But we do want to make something that matters out of our days. He turned to Marge and nodded to her, and she said, as if on cue with reverence, like a pitcher cries out for water, and Hopi vases were made to hold corn, we were made for work that is real. There is beauty in something well made, the minor poet said, a joy in work that sends birds out into the sky, or that helps a child learn, or mends a wound of heart or body, or builds something useful that makes a community stronger, that helps people navigate the hard parts of their lives. There's beauty in work done well. And we long for a world where everyone can do work that matters to them, and that they can do it well. And it would be great if that was work that people got paid for, and that it paid enough to live and breathe and take a vacation now and again and retire at a good age. But if that isn't what we do for a living, whatever we get paid for, whatever it is, we should be treated with decency, with respect, with honor, because our time is our heart, and our hands are sacred, and our labor is a blessing, not just a tool. We're not machines, but holy, incarnate bodies. And in our work and in our retirement from our work and in our studies before we work, we should be treated with fairness and justice, and we should treat others that way too. No matter what we do or did for a living, no matter what. And the minor poet took out his wallet and he put down a bunch of money, a tip for the staff here who has served us, he said. And they all followed suit. Even the conservative English banker was generous. And that was sort of it. They talked some more, but they began to drift off. Some took flu powder and some magic carpets, and some just got in their car and drove home. The grasshopper and the more minor poet were the last to leave. As the staff came in, the poet looked them in the eye and said, "Thank you for taking care of us." He departed, and the folks doing the work took over. They smiled at each other and chatted as they scrubbed and squinted their eye to inspect how clean the table was when they were done. And some of them went home to be with their family. And one of them went out for a run. And one of them took out an old, beat-up composition notebook and began to write. We'll sing together hymn 128, For All That Is Our Life.